Accession number 11281, reel 15.
Mr. Kelly, reel 15.
That seemed to be the pattern with the Germans, that they would resist for so long, and then they would go down into these massive bunkers that they had, and change into their best suits, pack all their gear, and then come out as though they were going on holiday, and surrender. And, of course, that's what happened. They held out for a little while against our troops, and then they'd pack up. And as they came back in, marching back to captivity, they were most annoyed when I took the greatcoats off them to cover the wounded, and I made them carry them. And they sort of, they looked to me as though they were going to remonstrate with me over my treatment to them, you know. And I just said to the chap who was looking after them, they only had one Marine at the front and one Marine at the back. I think that was all. I said, any messing out of them, shoot them. That's all I said to him, you know. That was only said in the heat of the moment. It was just the way they annoyed me. So they got round and they picked them up, because they carried our wounded back then, you see. So I made the prisoners carry them back, you know. So I didn't go back with them. I stayed where I was. Now, I didn't know how far forward our own lads had gone. And I had just my brain group left then. So I stayed the night in the in the bunker, the German bunkers. And I went down, I said to all of us, get your heads down, get some sleep. And we were hungry because we had nothing to eat. And there were tins there. And, I was a bit weary about opening tins. But we opened them and there were peas. So we had the peas, and then we had a sleep, and it was the light the next day coming through the doorway that woke me up, and I came out, everything was all very quiet, and it was just breaking dawn. So I decided it was a good enough time to move forward again. So I got the lads out, and they were a bit reluctant, you know, saying, well, can't we go back to headquarters and find out what's happening? So I thought, no. The lads have gone that way, so we'll go after them. So we pushed along, and eventually I found the troop again, and explained to Captain Stevens what had happened, although he was aware of most of the things, or appeared to be. And then we waited that night. Oh, that's right, we slept in the shivering on the top of these bunkers again. And they had huge steel doors. You couldn't get near them, you know. There's nothing we could open them up with. And we knew that there was tons of Germans inside them. But you couldn't get at them. There was no way you could put grenades down the vents, because the vents were stepped down. So that, the grenade would only drop a foot and explode. It wouldn't go rolling down into the bunker. And, we were told not to waste our time, that they'd come out at their own good time. So it was sometime the next day they came out, and we chased them off back down to the gap somewhere. And the more I saw them, the more I became... I wondered what they must have thought when they came out on the top, because they didn't see very many men. Many British troops, they couldn't possibly do them, because I couldn't see them, and I knew where to look. And, there just wasn't very many of us. And it surprised me that they had so much there, and so many weapons, and all this concrete, that they could not have made a fight of it. And they probably would have won if they had been determined enough. But anyway, it was our good fortune that they weren't, of course. Willing to fight. So anyway, the final episode came very soon after that. We were ordered to move forward again. So we were moving forward across the dunes again, and we were coming up to Battery 15. And when we got near Battery 15, the Germans were waiting for us, and the first time they'd used their skill. And they must have known every inch of the island from range points of view. And they certainly did on this occasion. And there was a huge saucer of a dune. Soft sand. And I think that was the saving grace, actually. And we just headed across there. And I was just coming along. Captain Stevens had gone across with his part of the troop. And I was coming up with my Bren group and the rest of the troop. And as we were crossing, the Germans dropped our shells or mortar bombs in there. And I remember getting slammed as though it was in there. You got a very violent push. But it's all down the side, you know, it's not in one particular place, it was right down the side, around my back. And I don't know whether I was hailed any distance or anything like that, but I remember smacked into the sand, which came as a great surprise. And I was pushing myself up when there was the other loud crashings going on, which I didn't take any notice of. And then I stood up and I felt, a bit funny, groggy, you know. And all I felt warm and wet, you know, on one side. But I still didn't realise what had happened. And I remember saying, take cover in the bunker. And there wasn't very many men in the hollow, you know. The house. Some were moving. Some were still lying on the floor. And that is where Mr. Smith, the Marine Smith, who had looked after me so well in Salerno, it was killed. He was killed there in that little salvo that we got. And I was very sad about that. And it upset me when they told me Smithy had been knocked out. Because he'd... He was the man you get this figurehead thing, from Salerno. He was my saving grace, and he epitomised the British soldiers to me, because he wasn't flappable, you know. He always seemed calm and cool, and every time he spoke to me. At Salerno, although he didn't make friends when I came back to Britain, and I didn't search him out or nothing like that. It was just in my mind about him. I used to see him at different times, of course, you know, have a little Smitty and probably had a few pints with him at different times, but I never made friends with him in that way. But he died there, and at attack, and Nutty Sherman was a casualty as well. And I think that just about wiped out my whole section. That was the lot of us that had all got suffered then. So we were evacuated from there after a long period. I remember we were lying there for a long time in this German bunker, and they couldn't move us because couldn't get near us, or the Germans had us so well covered. I'm not at all sure. But eventually we were taken out of there, and I was put into hospital in Antwerp, and eventually brought home.
How long did it take you to recover?
I was only suffering from, possibly the shock and multiple shrapnel wounds. I still have lots of little bits of my body at the moment, you know, but they don't cause me any harm or... any difficulty, and I haven't suffered with them. And some little bits used to come out in the bath at different times, and I'd just feel they come to the surface, and they'd be like like a wood splinter. And at first I thought they were, you know, but they were very tiny bits of metal. They took the bigger bits out, of course, you know.
Were you satisfied with the medical treatment that you got?
Oh, yes, yes. To be quite honest with you, I can't say that I was ever in any great pain. Other men looked as though they were in pain, but and you might act like you are, I suppose, but whether that's a reaction rather than a feeling, I don't know. But I can't say that I had any thoughts of I would actually die, and I didn't actually feel that I was too badly wounded, you know. Although I got a numbness sort of set in, you know, at least that, you know, I had a feeling that it was numb. But whether that was just the reaction of it, I don't know. But it soon passed off, and I think, well, I was home for Christmas, and that it was in, I was wounded somewhere around. We landed, I think it was the 1st of November when we landed at Walcheren, and it was, it would be something like about the 5th, 6th day when I got wounded.
Did you go back to Europe?
Yes, I came home, and which was became a little experience in itself. In the first instance, they transferred me from Antwerp Hospital to a hospital just outside London. And because I was a Marine and carried a naval passport, a naval pay book, although it was stamped in the back of my pay book, if this man becomes a casualty, he is to be returned to holding commando in Wrexham. Although that was stamped in the pay book, you couldn't get the other authorities to accept that. And I don't know for how long I was in a hospital in London. But when the time came for me to be, the doctor said, "Well, how do you feel?" I'm all right. So I said, "Feel okay." So he said, "Well, I'll send you off, you see." So I said, "All right, fine." So he said, "Well, you'll need a battle dress." Now, in that hospital, they had a sergeant who kitted me out very reluctantly for a battle dress, because he said I was a sailor. And I said, "I'm not a sailor." I said, "I'm a Royal Marine." I said, "I wear a battle dress like that." I said, I said, "just like you're wearing." He said, "I'll have to get some sort of permission," he said, "to give you one." Now, I had nothing because they cut all the clothes off, you see. So I only had a little bag where they'd put the little canvas bag, the string top, and all that was in it was my pay book. I had no money. There was just, I had nothing except no comb, no toothbrush, absolutely nothing. And when I went into that hospital in London, or just outside London, I was very surprised because they came round with a Red Cross truck, one of these voluntary things, you know. And the woman said to me, I wasn't in a military ward there, and I think there was only two of us in the ward, and it was a men's ward, of course. And the old chaps on either side of me, whatever they were suffering with, hernias and things like that, they were very sympathetic. And, of course, they were very interested to find a soldier amongst them, you know. They were asking me different questions, you know, and things like this. And I was getting on fine with them. But the thing was, I couldn't shave and I couldn't clean my teeth. And it annoyed me, especially me cleaning my teeth. And one chap lent me his razor. Well, of course, they were the razors with the razor blades in those days. And I shaved, and I felt very good after that. And this truck came round, and the woman came along. She said, "Oh, yes, I believe so." And whatever people were saying to her. And she pulls alongside me and said, "What would you like?" So I said, "Oh, well," I said, "can I have a toothpaste and a toothbrush?" soap and a writing pad and a pencil or the pencils then. They weren't none of these ballpoint pens. So she said, oh, yes. So she gets them all out, variety of little things, and she said, half a crown. I was sure sickness, you know. So I said, I haven't got any money. She said, shook them all back. And the two old chaps on either side played very hell with her. And I said, if you can't pay for them, son, she said, I can't leave them with you. So I said, well, I haven't got any money. I said, anyway, I said, the money that I would have had was BLA money. I said, you wouldn't have taken it off me. I said, it was occupational money, you know, the British Liberation Army or something. So they took them away. So the chaps on the other side of me lent me the pens and things to write home. And I wrote home, and my mother sent me 10 shillings. Through the post, so I was able to buy the stuff that I needed then, you know. So when it came to the time to leave there, they kitted me out with this battle dress. Now, the battle dress was quite a good fit, and it was Canadian. And so it was a greenier battle dress, than like a greenier colour, than the normal khaki ones that we had, and it was an immaculate fit. The only trouble was, that it had been one of the early ones, and it was full of white powder, this chloride and lime stuff they put in, you know, to keep the bugs out. And it took me ages to get rid of that, you know. But nevertheless, I had it for a couple of days, and I could get out of bed and get dressed, you know. I looked a bit like a soldier then. But he gave me a big pair of boots, one pair of grey socks, and a shirt. So, suitably kitted out, I said to him, he said, what about a hat? So I said, I wear a green berry. So he said, oh, it's a green berry? He said, I haven't got any green berries. So I said, well, so he said, I can't give you a berry then. So I had to sign for these things, and off I went. So when the time came for me to go, I was given a big envelope to pass on to my medical officer. And I carried all the x-rays, things like that, in it, you know. And I got this sergeant gave me a warrant. And off I went. So I went down to the railway station, and that's right, he wouldn't make the warrant out to Wrexham. So I said, well, where are you going to send me? He said, I don't know. He said, where do sailors go? Oh, I said, don't talk silly. I said, so I had no stripes on it, no badges of rank. There was nothing on it, just a plain battle dress I had. And no distinguishing marks on it at all. And I said, I'm telling you, I said, Wrexham, I said, it's in my paybook. There's the address. Oh, I said, I'm not sending you there. He said, no. So eventually we settled for Portsmouth. I said, I'm a Portsmouth rating. I said, my number is Portsmouth, 108397. So he said, right. I'll send you to Portsmouth. So I went down to the railway station armed with this warrant to Portsmouth. So armed with my x-ray photographs, off I went down to the station. So of course the chap in the booking office changes the warrant for a ticket to Portsmouth. And I walked through with it and handed it to the ticket collector. He punches it, and I immediately get punched as well. So two MPs, so I'm clashed between two MPs, and I'm smartly marched off. So I had to explain to them, or try to explain to them. And if you try to undermine the authority of two MPs by telling them that you are a corporal and you're a higher rank than they are, and besides that, I'm a naval rating and they are army, and they've got no jurisdiction over me. I'm afraid it falls on deaf ears when it gets to a stage like that, where they've got all of a person standing in battle dress, no berry on, no hat on, a pair of up-made boots that's obviously straight out of the stores, And they had no pity on me at all. So I was rescued by an officer in the Royal Artillery, because although they started to march me off, they caught me by surprise at first. And then when I suddenly realised, I just wrenched myself free. And I was standing there defying them, you see, on the platform. And I was saying, you know, the various things that they couldn't touch me because I was Admiralty and they were only Army and all this sort of stuff. And, of course, it was getting a bit noisy. Anyway, this officer came over from the Royal Artillery and they asked what was taking place. And I explained to him, I said, these two idiots, I've just come out of hospital. I said, there's my X-ray photographs. I said, look at the way I'm dressed. I said, now, if I were a spy, or if I were running away from an army unit, I said, would you expect me to be dressed like this? I said, would you? So he said, of course not, he said. He said, and he certainly wouldn't walk into a railway station like that. He says, where's your common sense? He said, I'll take charge of him. He said, now, you can leave him in my care. He said, and I'll see to him. And I'll be responsible for him. So we got on the train. Of course, he gets to the first-class compartment, doesn't he? I have to get the third class. So I never saw him again. But that meant that I did get the train journey to Pompey. So when they got out at Portsmouth, of course...
Where did they arrest you?
This was at Waterloo Station. Yeah, Waterloo Station, I think it was, yeah. When I got to Portsmouth, of course, it was the same thing again, wasn't it? Only this time it was naval patrols. So, of course, I go bouncing along there and I've got naval patrols and the red caps all making a beeline for me. And I thought, oh, no. This is beyond a joke, this. So the two parties arrived and demanding the carcass that the... You know, when I said I'm a Royal Marine, the Navy wanted me, and the Army said, he doesn't look like a Royal Marine, and they wanted me, so I said, oh, well, I'm going with the Navy. I said, take me down to Eastleigh Barracks. So I ended up in Eastleigh Barracks, which saved me the mission of getting a bus and furtively sneaking through the town, because I did feel self-conscious in this uniform. So I arrived in Pompey Barracks to be immediately thrown in the garter until they verified who I was. So I thought, smashing. What a way to come home. The conquering hero. So that after a short while, I wasn't in very long, and they decided that I was the genuine article. But they didn't want me on the premises, really. So they said, well, what we'll do... I said, well, all that I need to do is go to Wrexham. And at Wrexham, I said, they'll understand. I said, because they're dealing with wounded commandos all the time. I said, whether they're Marines or Army. I said, if you don't, you know, if it's putting everybody out by coming to these places, these establishments. I said, you know, it's better for me to go to the place. I said, there it is in the paper. So they looked at it and, of course, they'd never seen any like it. And they didn't even know about such things. And they were completely ignorant on the subject. So they decided that the simplest thing would be for them to send me home on a fortnight's leave, to kip me out with the rest of the gear and send me home on the fortnight's leave. And then at the end of the fortnight's leave, I personally would report to Wrexham. So I said, okay, I'll accept that. So I was sent home. They gave me another battle dress and another pair of socks and a better pair of boots and another shirt and some underwear, and generally kitted me out a bit. Oh, they gave me a blueberry with a big red patch on the side and a Marine badge. Of course, I had Royal Marines on the shoulder then, but that's all. So I arrived home like that, and I was very upset about that, because I didn't like the idea of the blueberry, and I didn't like to be at home for 14 days walking about like that. But however, I got over that, and I went back to Wrexham. And I reported to Wrexham. And what a difference. What a difference. Went in there, reported to the company sergeant major. So it took me in to see the CO. They'd all been wounded. They'd all been in action, all these men. And they all knew what it was all about. And they welcomed you there. Said, "Now, there's nothing for you to do. Your own free time. But the first day, do that." And they gave you a card. And it said, you know, I don't know, various headings, stores, paymaster, doctor, dentist, armory, and so on. And you went through the list. So you went to the stores, and they kitted me out again, and I got another battle dress. All the rubber sole boots that the commandos used to wear, the SV boots, and all a commando apparel, and a green beret. So they said, "Take one suit next door, and there's all the gear. They'll sew it all on for you. Then when that's done, come back with your other suit, put it in, and that will be done." So, you know, all the badges sewn on and everything else. So, and that happened. Perfect. You got all the gear, got rucksack with all the stuff in, smashing. All the weapon and that. Then I went to the armoury and they gave me a rifle of 50 rounds. Thought, good God, who am I going to shoot here? But nevertheless, there's staple diet of 50 rounds, a rifle of 50 rounds, and a penis. So, and then I went around, and it was so smooth an operation that you had all this stuff packed away by lunchtime, you know, and your second battle dress in, and you were walking around looking like what you're supposed to be, you know, a commando soldier. And I arrived at the dentist, and I'm afraid there I blotted my copybook. I'd been to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Well, are you all right now? I only had my arm bandaged then, I think, and some strips of plaster on my back and my backside. But my wrist, my left elbow was giving me a bit of trouble." So anyway, I went to the dentist, and he gave me the routine check, and then the next thing I knew, the drill was in my mouth, and he was drilling away, and of course, touched the nerve. When he touched the nerve, I hit him straight on the jaw. He goes down on the floor, and the staff sergeant who was with him jumps on me, you know. That's a little bit of a fracas there, you know. It just caught me. And I said, he had no right to touch my teeth. He said, "Well, it's only filling it." I said, "I don't care." I said, "Take it out." I said, "I don't want fillings." I said, "You should have taken it out." So he said, "No harm." He said, you're supposed to do it. And this fellow was sitting on the floor saying, "You're on a charge. You're on a charge." Because he was a captain, you see. So anyway, I walked out of there. Oh, he said to me, "Well, put some stuff in my mouth." He said, "Bite on that." So I was biting that. The staff sergeant saw me sooner. So I bit that, and I said, "Right." And I said, "Is that it?" So he said, "Yes, you can go now." So I walked out I was walking out the door, and I said, "Remember next time, ask." So I stamped out and went, I don't know where I was heading back. I think it's the last thing was the orderly room, the pay. And I was walking back there, and coming down on the other side was Colonel Taplin. He was the 2IC of the Holding Battalion. How he got to there, I don't know, but he had been badly wounded, or fairly badly wounded in Sicily, you know. So whether it was a reoccurring wound, or he might have been wounded again in Europe, for all I know. But he was on the other side of the room, and the road, and he saluted, and I saluted, and he said, "Come and have a pint afterwards."